I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The South Florida Water Management District is the largest in Florida, managing water needs for 7 million people. I'll speak with the newly elected chairman of the South Florida Water Management District, Dan O'Keefe, about the challenges he faces and the plan for Everglades restoration. And later in the program, 90.7's Nicole Creston talks to Orlando International Fringe Theatre Festival producer Mike Marinaccio. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Dan O'Keefe. He's a real estate attorney and lives in Windermere. Dan was appointed to the South Florida Water Management District by Governor Rick Scott in 2011, and he was elected chairman this year. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure. Glad to be here today.
Well, Dan, it's no secret that Florida has a limited supply of fresh water. Just how much do we have, and is there a danger in your mind that quality fresh water is running out?
Well, I would say that we are certainly in an area of the state that has a strained water supply, and that's one of the issues that our water management district is working on, and we're currently partnering with the St. John's Water Management District and the Southwest Florida Water Management District to address water supply issues as one of our big priorities.
What kind of a challenge is it going to be leading this water management district? I mean, you've got a pretty big challenge in terms of cleaning up the Everglades. Is that the most pressing concern for you?
That is a huge concern for me, and we really want to focus on our core mission, which is improving water quality, flood control, natural systems, and water supply. And when we talk about the Everglades, the big topics there are water quality and protecting the natural system. That's a huge focus, and it's a huge part of our annual budget, too.
You mentioned flood control. Is that something you think is going to become more of a concern with fluctuations in climate and bigger rainfalls, more sudden rainfalls followed by sort of more extended periods of drought, perhaps?
You know, we have a lot of scientists that work on that, and certainly flood control is an issue and a concern that we deal with every single day, and we've got thousands of miles of canals and hundreds of physical structures to move water, advanced pumps, and we've got really probably the best team in the world to deal with flood control. It's a huge issue. If it wasn't for all of our efforts, you know, a lot of South Florida would be underwater in its natural state.
Well, a lot of it was underwater before it was sort of built up, right? I mean, the city of Miami sort of arose from the water.
Yeah, much of South Florida was developed only because of digging canals and draining a lot of the wetlands. And now we've got a man-made system that operates that it requires a lot of expertise and a lot of money to operate that system every year. It is a big challenge. I kind of compare it to a hospital. You know, you start off with a hospital, and then you add another wing and another wing and another wing, but it's all got to function as one unit, mm-hmm. and that's how we are at the district. A lot of the systems that were put in place, you know, we've got engines and pumps that were out there for 50 years, and we're now looking at, you know, replacement of those, and you've got to maintain the system, and it's got to all work together. Fortunately, technology has been a big friend of ours, and we've been able to become a lot more efficient with the resources that we have.
Now, in the budget that just passed in the Florida legislature for 2013, $70 million around about was allocated for environmental restoration plans in the Everglades. Is that enough money?
I think it is enough money for this year, but we're going to need money allocated every year as we try to implement our Everglades restoration strategies. And we've worked closely with our federal partners from EPA to the Army Corps on trying to really control and limit the amount of nutrients that are discharged into the Everglades. And we've been dealing with that, trying to satisfy the federal requirements on that. And we've made tremendous progress over the last, you know, decade of reducing the amount of phosphorus is our biggest concern, discharges mm-hmm. into the Everglades system. And the Everglades is a, you know, it's a wonder of the world. It's a treasure not just for residents of the South Florida Water Management District, but for our state and for our country. And it's it's important, and it's gotten some recognition on a national level to realize that this is a very important natural system, and we need some resources to make sure that we can take care of it.
When you say phosphorus going in, are you able to just explain it? Where is that phosphorus coming from, and how is it getting into the Everglades?
Well, it's interesting. The Everglades actually starts in Central Florida. We're the headwaters for the Everglades, and between Shingle Creek and down to the Kissimmee River and Lake Toho, all the way down to Lake Okeechobee, phosphorus is, it's a natural ingredient from fertilizers. It's a natural ingredient from ranch operations and cattle. And in the past, there was a large amount of phosphorus that was discharged into the Everglades, which historically was an oligotrophic system, meaning it was almost devoid of nutrients. And so when you put a lot of phosphorus in there, you had blooms of growth of cattails and other invasive species that weren't native to the Everglades, and it changed the system. And so over time, we've been able to reduce tremendously the amount of phosphorus that's being discharged into there. Most of that's done through natural systems. We have, we call them STAs, stormwater treatment areas, large projects, thousands of acres, where you run the water through natural filters of plants and vegetation, from cattails to subaquatic vegetation, and it cleans that water in a natural system and then discharges it into the Everglades in a manner like it happened historically.
What about runoff from urban areas too? Because here in Central Florida, of course, there has been quite big growth, and that's probably going to keep going. Does that put a strain on the water as well?
Well, with the current regulatory systems that are in place, development today is much better in its discharges than it was historically when a lot of South Florida was developed. Today's development is much more environmentally responsible than it was in the past. Also in Central Florida, we've done a great job with reuse, being able to find alternative water supply for sprinklers and other what would have been users of the Florida aquifer can now use reuse as a source of water. We've done a great job in Central Florida on that.
So when you drive past a shopping mall or something and they have the sprinklers going and they have a sign saying reclaimed water, do not drink, that's what you're talking about there.
That's right. That's right.
Does that create a problem too, though, putting that water back into the ground? Is there still an amount of nutrient in that water which will then seep through into the aquifer?
That has not been a problem. With the natural filter that that exists in the ground, we haven't had any contamination of the aquifer from any reuse being utilized.
So on the one side, you have development, which, you say that there has been some advances made in the way that they deal with runoff and things like that. But on the other side of that too, people say that if the water isn't managed carefully, then that's going to be a natural break on development in Central Florida as well. If there isn't enough water to go around, we won't be able to expand at the rate at which people think we should. Is that a concern for you?
Yeah, and I think that kind of goes back to the whole water supply issue, and absolutely that there's not an unlimited amount of water, and we need to look at what the available sources are. And you look at some places around the state and around the world, and they've had to resort to very expensive water sources like desalinization plants, and those are tremendously expensive and not a very efficient use of our dollars. And so we need to find ways that we can protect the natural systems and address water supply issues.
Well, let's go back to talking a little bit about the Everglades. And one other piece of legislation that passed in this recent session, 30-year leases on land in the Everglades to sugar farming companies were approved. And that was something that environmentalists were a little concerned about when that legislation was put forward. What would you say to address those concerns? Do you have any concerns yourself over those 30-year leases?
Well, I think that the 30-year leases do make sense. I think if you look at the lands of the district, and we own hundreds of thousands of acres of land throughout the state, I mean, tremendous amount of land, we need to make sure that we're good stewards of that land. And with the agricultural leases that we have in place, we require that those farmers utilize, we call them BMPs, best management practices, and that's part of treating the fertilizer or phosphorus discharges from their waters, and helping so that the water that they discharge is much lower in those concentrations. They also pay special privilege, farming privilege tax to farm within the Everglades agricultural area, and that money is used towards Everglades restoration. The particular leases that were extended, I think part of that also had to do with making some lands available as part of our plan for the Everglades restoration and some key lands that we needed to make sure that we could move water where we needed to move it to be able to treat it efficiently and get it to discharge to the Everglades. And one other thing on the Everglades that everybody always kind of focuses on water quality going into the Everglades, but certainly water quantity going into the Everglades is an issue that's important also. And you can't dry out a natural system and expect it to function like it's supposed to. And you also can't over and deluge it with water where you've got, you know, 6 feet of standing water and it stays for a long period of time so that it's killing out both animals and those plants that we need to exist. So, you know, also part of our focus is making sure that we've got the right amount of water being discharged. One of the ways that we've been able to do that, address that issue, is we've got a water storage, dispersed water storage program, and we've done that in concert with the federal government, and it's been extremely successful. And it's kind of a cost-effective way, instead of going out and buying all the land where we want to store water during the wet season, we've partnered with private landowners, and we said, here's a way that you can help us achieve our goals, and we can store water during the wet season on your property with very little physical, you know, changes to their land necessary. And so we've partnered with ranchers and private landowners to say, help us store water during the wet season so that we have it when we need it during that dry season.
This is the dispersed water management, or does that come under a different title?
That's our dispersed water management programs. And we've done that in concert with the federal government, who's helped to pay for some of the costs of the dispersed water storage. But it's a lot more cost-effective way of doing it than having to go out, buy the lands, do all the physical improvements, and then just use it for our purposes during the wet seasons.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Matthew Petty. We're speaking with Dan O'Keefe. Dan is the chair of the South Florida Water Management District. What do you think the priorities of the South Florida Water Management District should be? You can contact us on intersection at WMFE.org or join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. I just want to go back to talking a little more about the Everglades. The proposed federal plan to improve the Everglades, it's over $1 billion, but you think the state can do it for less, is that correct?
The program that the federal government had been advancing was a very expensive program. It was well over $1 billion, and we put our best scientists to work at coming up with the goal of, tell us how we can do this in the most cost-effective manner. And that's really been a focus under Governor Rick Scott, is how can we accomplish our goals in the most cost-effective manner? And we came up with a system that's our scientists have modeled, and it really accomplishes all the goals that we're trying to accomplish with the Everglades, and it comes in at well less than $1 billion. And you know, our districts, we're blessed with great employees, fantastic expertise, and we're able to do things very efficiently. And I think our federal partners recognize that too.
And $880 million, I think that's the figure tacked to that cleanup plan. Is that right?
That is correct. And that would be shared by the state, the water management district. Some funding would have to come from the legislature on an annual basis. But we think we can achieve all those goals with a program that includes some additional lands for stormwater treatment areas, some flow equalization basins so that we're getting water to where it needs to go, and you know, a lot more plantings and treating that water with the kind of flowway systems that we were talking about.
So how do you do it for, you know, more than $100 million less than what the federal government says you should be spending on it?
Well, I think the federal government's plan looked at an alternative that included going out and acquiring a lot more land and just building massive stormwater treatment areas. And we've looked at it and we've said, how can we have the most efficient stormwater treatment areas possible? So we've looked at maybe a little bit harder focus on where those stormwater treatment areas are and how we get the water to them. And our modeling shows that that really works.
So back in 1988, there was a federal lawsuit brought against the South Florida Water Management District. The federal government said that they weren't happy with the way the state of Florida was going about that cleanup plan. Does this new $880 million cleanup plan for the Everglades put that lawsuit to rest?
Well, it doesn't necessarily put it to rest, but it does address all of the issues that were raised in that federal lawsuit. And so we think that with this plan, we're going to be in full compliance with the Federal Clean Water Act, and the judge in that federal case will likely maintain jurisdiction over the performance. We also have to go get all the federal and state permits in order to complete the works that we're talking about, and those permits will have performance thresholds on them also.
Now, looking at the cleanup plan, where does the funding come from? Because my understanding is that it's funded by property taxes, and there are some concerns perhaps that those property taxes might be declining in the next little while.
Certainly a portion of that $880 million comes from property taxes paid within the South Florida Water Management District area. And that area, it covers 16 counties in the state. We have a population of about 7.7 million folks that live in the district. And that will be one source of it, but there will also be state dollars that will be utilized. And that $880 million is spread out over about a 10 or 11, 12-year period. And then also part of that is to utilize some of the infrastructure that we already have in place. And that has been a big focus of ours, is to look at what infrastructure do we have, what lands do we own, and are we being good stewards of those lands.
Sort of getting better value out of water management, I suppose, or doing things for a lower price. I mean, how does dispersed water management play into that? You touched on it before, but my understanding is that you're asking the landowners, farmers, ranchers, et cetera, to take a little more responsibility for taking care of that water through their property.
Yeah, and we've looked to partner with those landowners, and actually when we look at what we need to do to affect stormwater storage during the wet seasons, and our normal approach would be go out and buy a bunch of land and then allow it to flood, and if it floods at a foot during the wet season for however many acres you've got 1 acre foot of storage. And what we've told these landowners in this program that we've done with the federal government is, hey, if we can use portions of your property that make sense for storing stormwater during the wet seasons, we'll pay you. And we'll pay you on a per acre foot basis. And it becomes a competitive system where if one landowner is going to do it cheaper than the next landowner next door, we have an ability to be competitive about it. And it's been a very good, effective partnership that we've enjoyed.
How long has this been going for, this program?
I think we started this program back in 2005, and it has grown over the years, and it has become a more significant investment for the district.
Let me ask you, too, I mean, there has been some criticism of the water management districts, not just the South Florida one, but in the last couple of years, environmentalists have said that they're concerned that the scientific side of the water management districts has been undercut. Do you have any concerns about the scientific backing for some of these decisions water management districts are making, your own and others as well?
Well, I can tell you that, in my private sector life, I'm a real estate attorney. And at Schutz and Bowen, when the economy turned down, we had to look at staffing, and we had to make sure that we allocated people where they, were most necessary. And you had to react to the change in the market. And I think at the Water Management District, we did the same thing. And the Water Management District, South Florida, from a staffing standpoint, had grown tremendously over the years. And I think we were at the height, I think we were at about 1,900 employees. And right now we're at about 1,600 employees. And we really do have phenomenal scientific support. And I think if you talk to the environmental community, I think there's a tremendous level of respect for the expertise that the district has. And I think that while you may have one or two in that group that say, oh, you guys need more employees, or you need better staffing, 98 out of 100 of them are going to say, you guys' staffing is unbelievable. And it's phenomenal, and we've been able to do more with less. We've we've gone from a budget that, you know, was about $1 billion a year, and that included some money for land acquisition. That so it kind of distorted it a little bit. It wasn't just operations, and now we have a budget that's about $600 million a year, and I think that our partners in the environmental community would affirm that we've done a very good job with those resources still of meeting our core mission.
Do you feel, though, that you're sometimes squeezed between two opposing things, the needs of developers and agriculture on one side and then the environmental community on the other side saying different things?
I feel that every day. And it is always a struggle. I mean, there's only so much water to go around. And you've got the needs of agriculture, and you've got the needs of utilities that want to make sure that when you turn on your sink or your shower that there's water there. And you've got the needs of the natural systems and the environment. And it's a balancing act. And so we try super hard every day. That's really a top priority for us to make sure that we balance that correctly.
I've been speaking to Dan O'Keefe. He's the chair of the South Florida Water Management District. Thanks for speaking to us, Dan.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Up next, 90.7's Nicole Kristen checks out the Fringe Festival.
It's a few minutes until curtain for the Fringe Festival show, Jet Backpack and the Battle at the End of the Universe. The crowd is still filing in to the sounds of William Shatner doing space-themed cover tunes, setting the tone for a night of offbeat, off-color, but good-hearted comedic sci-fi. Director Kevin Becker of Yes And Theater Company, a self-proclaimed sci-fi nerd, explains the concept behind the show.
Jet Backpack, it's a lot of like remembering when you were a kid and you used to have that little rocket ship that you'd fly around your backyard and land in bushes and shoot the neighbor's cat because it was this, you know, woolly mammoth or whatever, you know. And this show is definitely in that vein of kids at play and having fun.
And that's the beauty of The Fringe, says Becker. The festival gives performers a chance to do what they normally can't: cut loose, break in, take risks, or polish up their professional chops. Jet Backpack is one of more than 100 offerings at this year's Orlando International Fringe Festival. At 22 years old, it's the longest-running Fringe in the U.S., and coming off of last year's success, the festival is expanding. It's larger and longer than it's ever been. But for people who haven't experienced the Fringe, it can be hard to wrap your head around. Festival producer Mike Marinaccio offers this definition.
It is the most eclectic offering of live entertainment you will find anywhere. It's live performance of every single genre. If you like live music, we have amazing live local music on the outdoor stage. If you like puppetry, we have a 15-minute version of Nicholas Nickleby done by three puppets in a theater made entirely of cardboard. If you like magic, we have an illusionist with a chainsaw. I haven't even seen it yet. I have no idea what's going to happen. But if you like stand-up, we have amazing stand-ups, including Michael Winslow from the Police Academy movies. And just if you like drama, we have drama. We have musicals. We have dance shows. It's really something for everyone. And then the thing that makes Fringe really special is our mandate, our mission, and that is to present 100% unjuried, which means that there is no selection committee that says what art is valid and what art isn't. We are open to everyone. We want to give people who haven't had a chance elsewhere a chance to perform. So you'll have some of the most, you know, seasoned professional performers and then people who are getting up there for the first time and trying something brand new.
What's different about this year? I understand there are changes in size and length and location.
For years, we've been in Lock Haven Park, which is a gorgeous place. We have beautiful theater spaces, great partners. So we love Lock Haven. It's a great spot, but it's city-owned. There's not a lot of signage we can put up around it, so people could pass by Lock Haven Park and not even know that the Fringe was happening. This year, I wanted to expand outside of the park. I wanted to bring the local community involved. I wanted to get a little more of an economic impact on the local economy. I wanted to have more visibility. And really, the plan was to only add one venue. The plan was to add Theater Downtown. The longest continually running theater space in Orlando joins the longest continually running Fringe Festival in the United States. So that was a big thing for us. But then one of our longest tenured artists, Blue Star, signed the lease and began construction on her new theater space, which she calls The Venue, on Virginia Drive. that's how we added the two new spaces. And then we just sort of lucked out with this warehouse for Visual Fringe. The warehouse had gone up for rent. It's right across the street from our offices, right across the street from our new black venue, the venue on Virginia. And I just asked our landlord about it because she owns the space as well. And she said that she would love to let us use it. So we started planning to do a much bigger Visual Fringe. So now we have a Visual Fringe art bazaar, gallery, and mini golf. And now we're much more visible in the neighborhood. You drive down Virginia Drive, you know Fringe is happening. You drive down Orange Avenue, you know Fringe is happening. You come down Princeton and Mills, and obviously you know Fringe is happening. So we're hoping that that will, for this year, give us another big jump in attendance.
What is it that brings performers back year after year? What brings in new performers from here locally or from around the country? What is the magic of Fringe?
I think it's the sense of community that's created during the 2 weeks of Fringe is something that you can't really find the rest of the year. Everybody's together. Everybody's sharing a beer at the beer tent. Everybody is, you know, having these amazing experiences, watching these amazing shows, being inspired by each other, helping each other to develop and grow. It's a great way to kind of break into producing and kind of figure it out because it's the most inexpensive way for them to produce. And they can really take chances and experiment and do great work. And just having everybody together for 2 weeks, it just it's the sense of community is amazing. And we also sell really well. So artists make money, and that's what brings the internationals back year after year. We take good care of them. We put them up in housing, and we really work hard to take care of our international and national artists. I just want to give a piece of advice to all those people who are planning on coming out to the Fringe or who are thinking about coming out to the Fringe. Go see a show that you know nothing about. Go see the safe bet. Go see something that you really want to see. But then afterwards, go find something that you know nothing about and just walk into the theater and find it. One of the most beautiful things about the festival is that we're unjuried and not all the shows are professional. Yesterday I saw the Downtowners of Orlando Lutheran Towers doing Stayin' Alive 3. They are between 75 and 98 years old. None of them are professionals. Some of them have a hard time remembering the words to their songs. They sing Lady Gaga songs sometimes, or sometimes classics like What a Wonderful World. I laughed so hard I cried, and then I wept real tears when they got up there and sang Forever Young. And it is a show like that that can completely fill your soul, that is so much joy on stage from those performers, it can be better than the most professional, polished production that you'll see here. So take a chance.
That was Orlando International Fringe Theatre Festival producer Mike Marinaccio speaking with 90.7's Nicole Preston.
The end! Question mark!
The Fringe Festival runs until May 28th. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.
When I die and they lay me to rest, gonna go to the place that's the best. When I lay me down to die, gonna go up to the spirit in the sky. Going up to the spirit of the sky. That's where I'm gonna go when I die. When I die and they lay me to rest, gonna go to the place that's the best.